From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and Hillary Krieger, Enterprise Editor for CNN Politics Digital. And here are the issues. The Pope. Gee, this Pope is really, he generates more free media than Donald Trump even, and now they're involved together. Barbara, let me start with you. It was a seemingly innocent answer to a question by the Pope. He didn't issue an encyclical on walls, but he was asked about the wall that Donald Trump, the Republican presidential candidate, who is the front runner among Republicans, declares he wants to build. He's been saying this for months now. He wants to build a wall on the southwest border between the United States and Mexico and wants the Mexicans to pay for it. And the Pope said, anyone who wants to build walls like that, separating people, isn't Christian. Well, that became a very controversial statement, and Donald Trump responded, and I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah. I don't think he said a person is not. He said that kind of activity or behavior is not Christian. And Donald Trump, who never takes a punch lying down, came back and said it was disgraceful of the Pope to question his faith. Donald Trump never backs down. He never backs down. And if someone hits him, he hits back. Now, he is hitting back this time at someone who is revered around the world. I don't know how many people will decide how to vote according to what Pope Francis says, but certainly there are many Catholics in the United States, including working class people that might otherwise be attracted by Trump's populism, who might think twice about this. So, you know, we've talked about this for months. How far can Trump go? Every time we say no farther, he goes farther.
And he always seems to find somebody to help him dominate the media. It was the Pope.
Right. I mean, I think in this case, down the road, there could be some pitfalls for him in the broader Catholic community or certainly in a general election. But at the moment, he's trying to win South Carolina. And he now dominates the media coverage once again. You had Marco Rubio, who's challenging him, get a big endorsement from very popular Governor Nikki Haley. And instead of anybody paying attention to that, we are talking about Donald Trump once again. Very evangelical, heavy state. And they're not as keen on the Pope, and particularly a Pope seen as being liberal. And the issue is over, you know, what's happening with Mexico and immigration. And that is a winning issue for Trump with the Republican primary electorate. And I think, you know, there might have, for every eyebrow raised at Trump's response, I think there were people, Americans of faith, who were taken aback by the Pope's comments. You know, the Pope wasn't just challenging Trump with his statement. As Barbara said, it was a broader.
He was challenging all the Republicans
in a way. It was really all the Republicans and really any American that says you should be building a wall between the United States and Mexico. So I think there were a lot of people that were a bit defensive, you know, when they heard that.
And Hillary, do you think the Pope overreached on this? He was just answering a question, but that it was, as he's been accused by Trump and others, interfering in American politics.
It means that he is maybe not inappropriately interjecting himself in politics, but he certainly is now in the political arena. And that means that he is going to also be responding and receiving criticism as well, because he is positioning himself that way. So I think that, you know, he might be, say, within his rights to say that. But I have to say, you know, the Pope has really distinguished himself by saying, you know, who am I to judge? While he's reached out to Muslims, he's having this historic meeting with the Orthodox Christian Church. And yet here he is saying of, you know, an idea very popular in America, it's not Christian. And that is different in terms of he's been about inclusivity. And so drawing a line about something that's seen as not in keeping with the faith, I do think that there was something, a difference in terms of how he's staking out his position that certainly, you know, opens him to some criticism. And I think that's what happens when you put yourself out there that way.
Let's remember, too, he's the first Latin American pope, you know, and these are people who are Latin Americans who are surging across our border. So there may be an element of that. But he's certainly to the left of the Republican field. I think that's clear in his own political views.
Yeah, the question, though, Hillary has a point, though, that this time he did judge and said somebody who's for this wall, meaning Donald Trump, is not Christian. I can think of other ways that he could have said. He could have said, the wall's a bad idea. I hope they can work something out, and they should, and so on. And it would have been a position that he might get to. The Pope has had to walk back a couple of things he said earlier in the, since he's been Pope. We'll see what
Donald
happens.
Donald Trump does not walk back, though.
Right.
He just creates a new controversy. Yeah. He just throws another bomb.
It is amazing what he does for a guy who is running for political office for the first time, but really does know how to counterattack.
Right. Okay. If you want to talk about broken boundaries, and overreach, Trump has changed the rules of the game.
Yeah,
so everybody's just catching up.
He's breached a lot of political walls.
That's
Donald Trump certainly has. Okay. Supreme Court Justice Nino Scalia, the famous conservative on the court, died of a heart attack at age 79. And we come in February of President Obama's last year in office to the point of whether a successor, a replacement, should be nominated and voted on by the Senate, Barbara, or whether Congress should wait until the next president is elected. Could be a Democrat, could be a Republican. And that is elected and goes in office January 20th of 2017. That's the dispute. Democrats want to get a new justice who's more liberal. Republicans would like to wait, hope they win the White House, and get one who's more conservative.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that Obama has the right and will name someone. Whether the Senate will then hold hearings and even bother to vote is another question. That may not happen. But I think we have to understand the context for this. In some ways, this election is more important than our presidential election because it is going to affect the nature of the court in a way that nothing has since 1991 when Clarence Thomas, who's an arch conservative, replaced Thurgood Marshall, who was, of course, the opposite. And since that time, we've had a Republican majority on the court, and they have taken all kinds of steps to affect things like gun rights, the campaign financing. I mean, one of the things that people have really talked about is this issue. But I see you want to pause for a second.
Well, I do want to pause because we're going to have to take a short break. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with Hillary Krieger and Barbara Slavin. Did you want to continue?
Yeah. There are so many issues where a change in the balance of the court, if you have five liberals versus four conservatives, you're going to have a major effect on things like campaign finance. You're not going to have what we have, this decision called Citizens United, which basically allowed unlimited amounts of cash to enter the political system with almost no restrictions whatsoever. I mean, that would certainly be cut back. You would protect a woman's right to choose to have an abortion and make sure that there weren't further inroads there. Gun rights, voting rights, issue after gay marriage, issue after issue after issue that could be affected by a change in the composition of the courts. So that's why the Republicans, I think, are digging in their heels and are so reluctant. They would rather flip a coin. But it's dangerous for them because if Hillary Clinton, say, becomes the next president of the United States, they're likely to face a much more liberal nominee than Obama would appoint this year. I think Obama will go for a more mainstream choice, somebody who's already been approved, perhaps a sitting judge, who's already been approved by the Senate and has a chance, at least a chance, of being confirmed.
Hillary?
I mean, I totally agree that Obama is much more likely to choose a moderate justice so that, first of all, there's a chance of getting that person through because the stakes are so high, but also for the political optics of it to show, you know, the American people, look, I put forward somebody that was confirmed potentially unanimously previously, but that, you know, there's one name.
I'm not sure that person exists.
Well, there's Sri Srinivasan. Right. He's an Indian American. Mm-hmm.
And he was confirmed 97-0, and Ted Cruz actually had some positive things to say about him. So, you know, and the fact that he wouldn't potentially even get a vote would be a way of trying to score some political points on the issue. You know, Republicans see that they have, you know, political gain here to show their voters, look, this is why you have to come out. We need to have control of the court. But it could also backfire in terms of energizing people on the left, you know, especially if you see somebody like Hillary Clinton, who's had a real problem with the progressive wing. You've seen such enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders, and she's just not been able. She's tried different ways. She has not been able to get those people to come out for her. And if she's running in a presidential race in which there's an open Supreme Court vacancy, that might be a winning way for her to get those people out. So the Republicans are definitely playing a risky game. And they're saying that basically it's okay with them to leave the Supreme Court open for over a year because when you bring in a new president, it's not like day two there's a new Supreme Court justice. And these are huge, important issues that the court is looking at that would go unattended to. And that also can really look bad to an American public that's saying, hey, you Republicans are trying to say that you're trying to be responsible and govern.
Yeah, capable
and
of governing.
There's no question. There's no question that Obama has the right to do it.
There's no question about the right. The question of whether Republicans in the last year of his office or hasn't been nobody, there hasn't been nobody, hadn't been anybody nominated and confirmed in the last year of a
by
president's term in 80 years. My question, though,
by
is
happenstance.
This.
I mean, that
Justice
Kennedy.
That doesn't mean it couldn't happen, of course.
Justice Kennedy was confirmed in the last year.
Right, though he was nominated before it was the final year.
Yeah, by 2 months.
But, but I mean, Republicans keep saying there's a precedent as though there was some legal standard that previous case law had determined. No justice had died. I mean, this is to call it a precedent. It's a coincidence.
Yeah, they're padding their case on that one. But here's my question. What would Democrats do if they were in there in the same position?
I'm sure they would do the same. They wouldn't say that the president had no right. I think they just if they were in control of the Senate, you know, again, it would depend on the nominee, too.
I disagree.
I think Democrats would say, oh, that's fine. We'll
no, I think Democrats would do the exact same thing. I think it points to the deep, entrenched problem of the political system. Mm-hmm. It's not about one person who can be a uniter. There is something much more fundamental in both sides digging in against each other, as opposed to simply trying to do what they can to promote the most part of their program. Mm-hmm. You know, you even had, I think, some comments when there was a previous confirmation issue towards the end of a term with Democrats saying, well, this might not be, you know, such a great idea to go so fast on this. And I think it's sort of the Democrats' fortune that it's the tables have turned on and they're in the ones that, you know, get to like show the American public that, hey, we should be able to do this. And the Republicans are, you know, objectionist. And that fits in with a narrative, of course, in which the Republicans have set themselves up as a party of no, a party of obstruction. And it certainly plays into that narrative.
The so far the poll, the initial poll showed it was sort of evenly divided. Should president nominate somebody and that person voted on or not, or should Republicans block it? My own view is that Republicans, because of their leaders are under such fire from the conservatives in the party, don't have much flexibility on this, that they're not going to let the president nominate someone purely for political reasons, but that's the way it works. And let me just ask one question about what about Justice Scalia? Why is he so well known and such with such a powerful figure, Barbara?
Well, he certainly was kind of the epitome of conservative thinking on the court. He was also the longest serving justice. He was an originalist. He tried to sort of, at least he claimed, to go back and imagine what the architects of the Constitution had in mind when various provisions were put in there. In fact, he had a very hard right agenda that favored big corporations, gun owners, people who think that women should not have abortions, should not have the right to have abortions. And he was very outspoken in that area. On the other side, he was also apparently personally a very charming man. He formed a lot of good friendships with unlikely people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg,
and a
for
very
example.
Lively writer.
Lively and just an outsized personality altogether. One of the questions going around now is, you know, what will Clarence Thomas do? Because he never, ever voted in a way that did not reflect what Scalia was up to. And Scalia wrote many opinions and so on. So, you know, who will Clarence Thomas look to for guidance now?
I think he'll probably do fine on his own. Hillary, what about Justice Scalia?
Well, I think that, you know, he basically reshaped not just in terms of his opinions and where he came down, but the tone of, you know, the court in terms of the way his opinions had a real personality to them. They weren't just dry legal recitations. And the way the questions that he asked, you know, he really changed the way that those questions during oral arguments were played out by being much more provocative, much more personality driven. And, you know, I don't know that there's really a direct line between the way that personality he brought in those realms to what we've seen with the Supreme Court, but it is the case that over his lifetime, his tenure on the court, the Supreme Court has become a more personable, more identifiable body. You know, you now have Supreme Court justices writing books and on tours and giving lectures and giving interviews, things that you hadn't seen them
as doing. Well, it's televised now.
Yeah.
Not live television, but certainly you can hear them.
You can't see them though. I'm gonna have to take a break here, and we'll be right back with more issues in the news.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and Hillary Krieger. I think we've talked enough about American politics. We're going to have to squeeze in a couple issues here quickly that I mentioned in the introduction. The first is, Barbara, what are the Chinese up to? What do they need anti-aircraft weapons on Woody Island in the South China Sea? I mean, it's a provocative act.
It certainly is. You know, China is not doing terribly well these days, shall we say. Their economy is in trouble. They're burning through reserves, trying to support their currency. And the Chinese system has evolved so that it's no longer, I mean, I think Bernie Sanders is more socialist than China is now. It's a kind of unique combination of crony capitalism and ultra-nationalism that keeps the state going. And so these kinds of acts, expanding little dots in the South China Sea into, you know, into landing strips, putting now anti-aircraft missiles on an island in the Paracel chain, this is a way of showing that China is strong and China must be feared and other, you know, powers should quake. But it's very provocative. This happened while President Obama was hosting a summit of Southeast Asian nations and leaders in California, and they all denounced it vociferously. And Obama reiterated that the United States will continue to, quote, fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows. So we'll send our ships through there, and we're not going to let our planes be deterred by the fact that these missiles are there. You know, if the Chinese ever decided to actually use those missiles, though, we could have a major international incident.
Hillary, what about that? I mean, that's what I mean. This is provocative, and you think, well, this will blow over. It's not that big a deal. But stranger things that have happened that you get wars as a result.
Right. I mean, you can't take it lightly when you're talking about major militarization of disputed areas. I don't think it came as a coincidence that this happened at the same time that President Obama was meeting with leaders from Southeast Asian nations in a very unprecedented summit where they had come to California and, in fact, were working out a statement of where the U.S. is, you know, talking about its support for their alliance and for halting what's happening in didn't specifically say China, but the implication was clear that the U.S. is calling on China to stop what it was doing there. You know, Obama has made important part of his foreign policy trying to make sure that America is much more present in Asia and is reassuring those allies that China is arguably encroaching on, that it's going to be present. But China is willing to take a risk in terms of, you know, what resources it puts out there, what, you know, could potentially spark some sort of conflict that they feel that they'd be in a very dominant position to win. And they think, you know, it's much more important to send the message to the United States to back off, that this is, you know, the United States might see it as disputed. China doesn't see any dispute.
I believe Taiwan and Vietnam both claim this island.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the United United States and China right now are going, you know, countermeasure. And while they're small steps individually, over time, you know, you see the progression. And certainly that, you know, can lead you to quite a big a buildup that can really explode in a confrontation, though I don't think either country wants that. I mean, both sides are trying to assert their authority and demonstrate their strength without getting to a hot conflict.
Okay, let's turn to Turkey and the Kurds. This is an ongoing dispute. In particular, 28 people were killed, and the Turks said it was Kurdish militants, including a group that is backed, I believe, by the U.S. and as a part of these supposed Syrian peace talks. Where does this lead, Barbara, if anywhere?
Not in a good place. You know, Turkey is a NATO ally of the United States, but the U.S. and Turkey have many, many disagreements over a host of issues in the region, and Syria in particular. The most effective fighting forces against the Islamic State have been Kurds, Syrian Kurds. It's a group called the YPG. The Turks assert that this group is affiliated with something called the PKK, which is a Turkish-Kurdish group that has been fighting for Kurdish rights in Turkey.
For decades, right?
For decades. Mm-hmm. And there was a peace process that Turkey had with this group, and then it fell apart. And now they are at each other's throats again. Now, it's not clear whether the PKK was responsible for this bombing in Ankara. It could have been Islamic State. It could have been far leftists. Turkey is a very unstable place right now, I'm sorry to say. But it puts the United States in an impossible position because the groups that Turkey supports in Syria are not effective at all, and they are being bombarded relentlessly now by the Russians. Increasingly, it looks as though the only viable forces in that country are the pro-Assad forces, backed by Russia and Iran, this Kurdish group, backed by the United States and Russia, and some say also Assad, not clear, and the Islamic State, and maybe the Nusra Front, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate. The other rebel groups are hanging on by their fingernails, and they're at each other's throats. They've never been able to develop a coherent opposition to Assad. The only good news that's come out is that some humanitarian relief was delivered finally to besieged cities in Syria, but a ceasefire that was to have started on February the 19th did not come about.
No, that's not a real surprise.
It's not a real surprise.
Hillary, what about this? And I mean, Turkey's in such a sensitive position, refugee-wise. I think there are 2.5 million refugees from Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq and so on in Turkey. If the Turks unleash them, you could have another huge surge of refugees into Europe. And I mean, Turkey is in an enormously sensitive position.
Yeah, and it sometimes feels that they're trying to use that position as a bit of a bargaining chip.
It does,
with the United States particularly, they pushed the U.S. to give them Patriot batteries in an earlier round of the conflict. And, you know, right now, because of their support for groups that the United States is much less comfortable with on the Islamic extremism spectrum, the United States doesn't want to see them doing more of that. And they really don't want to see them shelling the YPG, which is, as Barbara said, the most effective and reliable ally of the United States. It's not simply that they are a group that's been effective against, the Syrians and the metastasizing ISIS, but also that they have been in Syria and Iraq good partners for the United States and have been having, you know, more of, say, a Western-oriented outlook.
The Turks oppose any group that wants to create a Kurdish state, right?
Exactly. Basically, Turkey came out in a remarkably short amount of time blaming this attack on Kurds. There was really no evidence of that. Mm-hmm. And certainly, there had been no claim of responsibility. Mm-hmm. There hadn't been a lot of time for forensics. There have been several other groups, as Barbara mentioned, who have been behind similar violence in Turkey. And so it really looked like they were trying to take an opportunity to blame it on the Kurds to justify their, you know, they have been not just attacking the PKK, which is a domestic organization which has been behind some terrorism attacks in the past, but the YPG, which really hasn't been, and to say that it's also to get legitimacy for what they're doing, which is very contrary to United States interests.
Well, thank you both very much. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and Hillary Krieger, Enterprise Editor for CNN Politics Digital. The program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Jackson Witt and Jonah Cummings. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.